Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends for doctors in women's health. I'm Lindsay Carr, the associate editor for Contemporary OBGYN. You'll hear from me as well as my senior editor, Angie DeRosa.
Hello, I'm Angie DeRosa, senior editor of Contemporary OBGYN. As we start into the summer months, we continue with our coverage of COVID-19 and its impact in pregnancy. Research obviously continues in earnest, and we want to bring you the latest information. In this next video, we interview Emily Miller, an obstetrician gynecologist at Northwestern Medicine in Chicago. Dr. Miller and her co-authors on a recent study that was published in the American Journal of Clinical Pathology made a very interesting finding that there are changes to the placenta in patients who are positive for this virus, with evidence of maternal vascular malperfusion. Though the study was small, 16 patients whose placentas were examined and they had delivered between March 18th and May 5th, third trimester placentas were significantly more likely to show at least one feature of MVM, particularly abnormal or injured maternal vessels and intervillous thrombi, the study results said. In this exclusive video that you'll see next, Dr. Miller discusses MVM and what she has seen in her clinical practice and research, including the impact of socioeconomic status in how patients are able to socially distance. Thank you for watching, and please stay tuned to Contemporary OBGYN for more information and coverage on COVID-19. You can find all the latest information at www.contemporaryobgyn.net. Thank you. So thank you for doing this interview with us today. We really, really appreciate it.
Of course. And thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. And you have a lot of really exciting things going on in terms of what you're doing and seeing leading the COVID-19 efforts. Is it at Northwestern completely? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we have a, Northwestern Memorial Hospital is a conglomerate of hospitals, and Prentice Women's Hospital is where our labor and delivery unit and postpartum floors, et cetera, are located. And so I've been very engaged with the COVID response at Prentice. And obviously, it's really integrated with our MICU teams, our, medicine floor teams, and our emergency department. So a lot of cross collaboration.
What are the most significant outcomes that you're seeing with COVID-19 and pregnant patients?
We're not seeing anything novel compared to what's been reported. And I say that with a lot of relief that luckily we know so far, knock on wood, most of the time what to expect, because we've really been able to utilize communications with our colleagues or platforms like this to learn what's been happening at places that were hit before us. So, we're seeing similar symptoms to what's been described when women do come in and they are symptomatic in terms of cough, body aches, fevers. We started universal testing maybe 6 weeks ago, and we're seeing about half of our cases are identified via universal testing, meaning they're asymptomatic. So again, not dissimilar from what we had learned from New York previously. And, we're seeing that many of our, what we were calling our asymptomatic women are developing symptoms postpartum. We haven't seen too many women get very sick, but about 20% of women are reporting, a cough or malaise that develops within the first few days postpartum.
And has that been a consistent outcome where if they've tested positive for it and they're asymptomatic prior to delivery, then after delivery, they develop the symptoms?
About one out of every five, we're seeing that. And again, anytime I see these numbers, I have to say with utmost caution, we have 70 positive SARS-CoV-2 women who have been identified with SARS-CoV-2.
Okay.
And 35, I believe, of them have delivered. So, we're talking reasonably small numbers. So I'm always really cautious with what we're concluding. But around 20% of women who come in without symptoms will have symptoms a few days after they go home.
What is being advised once they go home with baby?
Yeah, so the discharge process has been really a great collaboration with our pediatric colleagues. And, who goes where is really dependent on their social circumstance. Mm-hmm. And our pediatricians, I think, do a really great job of individualizing that based on the social constructs of that individual family. So we obviously try to have baby go into the home where the mom is if she can quarantine, if there's a healthy caregiver that can predominantly take care of the baby. In some settings, the families have said, gosh, bring the baby to another healthy, unexposed family member until we can recover. And so that is certainly individualized. We connect with these women by phone through a really great hospital-wide COVID monitoring program and ask them, we have actually a group of medical students that are being supervised and call every day and ask about symptoms, and we'll continue to track until they're either 3 days asymptomatic or and then once they're discharged from the program, they're kind of linked back in if symptoms redevelop. So it's been a nice way to continue to track and to know that these moms are getting a little bit of extra support and they know who to reach out to if anything changes.
That's really nice. When did that get set up? How long has that been functioning?
Probably a month, 6 weeks ago. Time for all of us is moving at a very impossible to track clip. But it's a really phenomenal program, and was a really great way to involve many of our medical students when their clerkships became virtual. So it's been really helpful to know that there is a support program and that people are being connected with folks with clinical acumen to make sure they're doing okay.
And have you seen any of the babies test positive?
We have not, knock on wood. Certainly there's, been cases that have been reported that are fairly compelling. Of the 35 deliveries we've had so far, we have not had any.
So I guess then that goes, you touched a little bit on the advising patients who are positive for COVID-19, if they're before they deliver, if they have weeks or months before they deliver, how are you advising those patients?
Yeah, and this is certainly a work in progress. It seems as if we actually had looked at the placentas of the first 16 women that delivered and compared to historical controls and various subtypes of controls to see what might be going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw a really remarkable number of these placentas had maternal vascular malperfusion, which is not a particularly specific placental lesion. Those of us that look at placentas see it a fair bit, but it is associated with preeclampsia, with growth restriction, with preterm birth.
Okay.
And so it suggests, at least to me, again, with the huge caveat that this is small numbers and this is looking at the placenta is a very intermediate outcome,
okay,
that these pregnancies are at risk of growth restriction or preeclampsia. So we're monitoring with serial growth ultrasounds and then using those growth ultrasounds to inform whether we would do additional antenatal testing.
Okay. And state for me again what it is that specific, what it is you're seeing, maternal
Maternal vascular malperfusion.
Okay.
It's basically the placenta side, the maternal side of the placenta, is not being perfused as well as we hope it would be.
It's
and that makes a lot of sense when we think about okay. the thrombotic risk, the maternal or the patient thrombotic risks that we've seen reported, right? That there does seem to be these thromboses that occur. And okay. so this might be happening in the placenta just as well as it is across those infected with SARS-CoV-2, their bodies.
It's fascinating to me, the role of the placenta.
Yeah.
And the things that doctors are able to tell from that. And even with Dr. Spong and the Human Placenta Project at, and so hearing that from you, you haven't seen any evidence, it sounds to me, like a vertical transmission.
Correct.
Yes. So what about anything via breast milk?
We haven't had the opportunity to test breast milk, just because of research infrastructure limitations. But to my knowledge, and I there haven't been any babies that have become infected of the women who have delivered here.
Okay. Now, because as you said too, the what you spoke about you haven't seen anything much different than what's being reported at large. And we published a recent report from authors in Peru about potential vertical transmission. And then I don't know if you had the opportunity to see the interview that we did with Dr. Christina Adams-Waldorf out of the University of Washington. Some maybe indicators that vertical transmission, but very limited. So that's why I was following up on that to see if there would be anything on your end.
Yeah, and I should use the caveat that when I say there's no vertical transmission, the way that we're assessing that is only a nasopharyngeal PCR
okay.
in the neonate. We haven't had the ability to test antibodies yet.
Okay.
And cord blood. And, you know, there's a team of researchers here and we're working on the ability to do that. But I think the test characteristics, particularly of the IgMs that are commercially available, are a little bit limited. And so we're, you know, waiting until we can really feel confident about accuracy before we test the samples that we have banked.
Now, I did, Dr. Riley, Laura Riley and I touched on this a little bit, and it's not on the question sheet, but certainly because of where you're located, I would like to ask you about the socioeconomic disparities. And if
yes.
you can speak to that, especially in Chicago.
Yeah, unfortunately I can. And it's, again, the same lessons we've learned from other places. But it is remarkable to see. We've cohorted our pregnant women with COVID-19 in a kind of a separate floor of the hospital. And so we can compare on a day-to-day basis what's happening on that floor versus our regular labor and delivery unit, a floor below. And it is stark how the sociodemographics differ. Mm-hmm. And it's made us all very aware of how social distancing is such a privilege, and that many of our communities don't have that privilege and are, you know, working in the grocery store or working to deliver mail. And that, you know, they take great care to mitigate exposure, but you can't eliminate exposure when you're out in the community and working. And even if it's not their patients, it's someone in their family or someone in their household. And so it's really, it's very eye opening to how challenging that is, and how that is, it appears, again, very, very broad strokes, to be a mechanism by which the epidemiology is really targeting specific neighborhoods and specific sociodemographics.
Okay. Now, Dr. Spong, as you may have seen on that Fifth question, she did, and I don't know if you read her or not, but in our May issue, she did the column about the lessons that can be learned, how practitioners should take from this, think about the lessons. And so I wanted to ask you about that for yourself, your institution, and region. What do you hope OBGYNs get to take from this to build on for the future of the practice and patients?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think there's been so many lessons that we've all learned. I mean, starting from the very basic of the foundations of epidemiology that we've all been trained on, uh-huh. You know, incorporating that into decision making. So, you know, we know there's myriad testing platforms, just as an example, that uh-huh. are out there with varying sensitivities, and how we incorporate those into our clinical decision making really depends on the negative predictive values. And so, you know, hearkening back to our 2x2 tables and thinking about how our prevalence is going to inform our negative predictive value and how we can fold in sensitivities of testing platforms, I think is really important for us to be able to make the right decisions for our institutions and how we're going to use test results okay. to inform, you know, any changes in clinical management. So I think that's been important. I think another big lesson within our institution is the importance of multidisciplinary planning and engagement.
Okay.
And every decision that we make has a unique impact on different stakeholders. And so, you know, while it might make sense for me to, you know, change PPE just as an example in response to a negative test, our nursing colleagues who are at the bedside and closer with patients, they might feel differently. Our infection prevention colleagues might have a different perspective. Our environmental services team that's cleaning the rooms might be viewing how we think about these tests differently. Yeah. And so I think it's, and our pediatricians have a totally different lens, you know, when they're coming into the room and potentially performing an aerosol generating procedure with intubation of a newborn. So I think it's been really important to engage all stakeholders before we make big decisions, and make sure that we're hearing the lens of our entire team, and not just through the lens of obstetricians. Along the same lines, I've learned a lot by staying engaged with community. And I have the privilege of getting to work with a group of community activists focused on prevention of maternal to child transmission of HIV. And it was actually through those relationships that I was informed that on the listservs and on social media in these communities, women were considering home birth. And it would never, as a, you know, hospital-centric maternal fetal medicine physician, it would never have crossed my mind that women living with HIV would be discussing home birth because they felt that a labor and delivery unit might be an unsafe place for them and their newborn. And so knowing that allowed us in our women's HIV clinic to kind of get in front of that issue and talk more proactively about it, because we knew that those conversations were happening in other platforms. So I think really being able to listen and hear the perspectives of our other colleagues and our patients is so important so that we can be targeting the right messages and, you know, making the best decisions.
Absolutely. And that you've, so there is, am I correct? There is an HIV research. Is it a lab? What is the group that you run at Northwestern?
Oh, I'm involved in our women's HIV clinic.
Yes.
And so it's a infectious disease, maternal fetal medicine, nursing, psychology, social work, multidisciplinary clinic where we care for pregnant and parenting women living with HIV.
And so some of the lessons learned from that, that carry over to what you're doing now, What have you seen in terms of that overlap?
Yeah, it's, you know, I wasn't around during the beginning as we were all first learning about HIV and AIDS, but I'm actually in the middle of reading the book And the Band Played On and started reading it before the pandemic. Uh-huh. And really the parallels in terms of the fear, the stigma, the decisions that were made are, you know, there's a lot of lessons we've learned, but there's a lot of lessons we haven't learned in terms of how to mitigate stigma and how to compassionately care for communities that are affected by something that we don't fully understand.
Yeah, and I think that seems like such a big thing with coronavirus too, is not understanding it. And I was around in the 80s when everything started happening with HIV and AIDS, and we seeing how that all turned out. But the time that it took, the human toll mm-hmm. that it took, is really quite an intriguing and amazing story. I haven't read that book, but I should. Thank you for reminding me about it.
Yeah, there's a lot of lessons about, you know, this juxtaposition of, you know, the public health impact and knowing about how to reduce risk, but the concept of, you know, people's individual liberties to get to. And you know, we're seeing the same thing play out in many states and many arenas now. So it's a challenging thing to leave the hospital and go home and read, but I'm really glad I'm doing it.
So tell me, speaking of leaving the hospital and going home, we're asking all of you also, what are you doing for self-care?
it's obviously it's important. And I think, you know, I won't say I'm great at it, but practicing mindfulness, reading, trying to carve out time. I have a 1.5-year-old and a 3.5-year-old. So, home is usually a little bit busy, but there is such great reminders of the vibrancy and energy and that there is a world outside this hospital, and thank goodness they're healthy. So I think they're really refreshing reminders to me of the bigger picture and how much joy there can be, in life. I also think, I've been really lucky that I hadn't really appreciated before the communities that we've all developed, with other obstetricians around the country, with other maternal fetal medicine physicians around the country. And within my hospital, I mean, having groups of people locally and across the country and internationally that are going through the same thing, and having those kind of outlets and having platforms like this that facilitate those outlets has been huge, to know that you have a group of people that knows what you're experiencing. Yeah. And even with a quick text or phone call or whatever, can you know that there's a shoulder to lean on.
And have you in Chicago, here? So we're in Cleveland, and you know we're starting to creep out, so to speak, of the shelter in place. And what are you seeing there in your area in terms of returning to what Dr. Spong called the, you know, what's going to be the new normal?
Yeah, we're still shelter in place at least until the end of the month. Okay. There's a phased approach that's informed by the epidemiology that the state is seeing. And I'm grateful that we have, politicians that are really listening to the science and are making decisions based on that science. So I think we're, even though we're still seemingly on an uptick in terms of identified cases, mm-hmm. It seems as if we're making the appropriate slow responses, even though those are hard decisions to make.
Yes. And worrying about any second wave and all those other things. Is there anything else you would like to say with regard to being a practitioner in this environment,
and add to anything that I may have missed during this interview.
No, I think, you know, thank you for getting information out there. I'm really amazed at how you guys and SMFM and ACOG and all of the other journals are really disseminating. And I think that's been really important for us all to be able to have the information we need as much as we can to, as much as what's available to make the best decisions. So thank you for all that you're doing to get the word out there.
Well, I tell Dr. Spong, I never could be trusted with a knife, so I would never be a medical person, but my family is, and you guys are heroes. You are. And so thank you. I mean, really. And the time, the hours that you're putting in and everything that you're doing, thank you.
You know, we're all in it. We're all contributing in our own way, but it's, you know, it is a privilege to have a skill set that's useful and can serve the community. So there's a blessing there.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PAP Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.